Thank you, Mr. Horton. Yes, we're like the Cavs. We have a deep bench here. Literally. Dull week in Cleveland, eh? Still recovering from it, still cleaning up from it in some ways from what I hear. Our son and daughter-in-law came to town and they were going to take me downtown and said, what time do you think we ought to go? And I said, 5:30. And he said, 7, you said. Okay. So at 7 o'clock, we turned on the TV and had a decision to make. And so we list pros and we list cons. And pros of parents' house was parking, bathrooms, coffee, mom's cooking, TV. It wasn't hard. So were any of you down there? Were any of you down there? All right. On purpose? Very good. I wish I could have been part of it. I really do. So it's been a good week. A few weeks ago, in the mail, I got this odd package. I never know what I'm going to get in the mail. I never even remember what I ordered on Amazon or eBay. And so when packages come, we just kind of think, I wonder what Mark's ordered now. But I didn't order this one. The New York Times, which is a little newspaper out of New York City, is aware of me, apparently, and they sent me, I know they called once for me to subscribe, and you know, you get the sales call, and I picked up the phone, and he said, hello, this is Jim from the New York Times, and I said, I don't give interviews, and I hung up the phone. But they sent me this, and it turned out to be astounding. It's this little box, and you open it up. Did any of you get one of these? So it's just me. Now, if you've been to school, school students have probably experienced this because they've sent them to whole classrooms. But you take your phone and you turn to the New York Times app, and there's other apps too. And this is a virtual reality machine. So you, in this case, you put your phone in it, and they make them out of heavy-duty plastic and metal and things like that. But this is. This is the cardboard virtual reality machine. And I was just astounded. I mean, Taya will tell you that you look into it, and you should have headphones for the noise, but you can look up, you can look down, you can look all around. I'm in Montana right now. You could be underwater watching porpoises, but oh, there's a big buffalo there grunting. And I'm looking at mountains. This is the National Bison Range in Moise, Montana. If any of you want to see it, there's the Mission Mountains out there, and there's, you just never know. You can go three, that's awful close. There's a huge bison right there. And of course, it was just a camera, so the bison probably wants to know what's going on. Oh, he's rubbing on it, okay. Anyway, it's just astounding. It's like holding an IMAX in your hand. There was a flyby of Pluto that was just one of the most breathtaking things I've seen. If any of you want to experience this after services, please feel free. But I kind of like the Bison Range one because the Bison Range has played a role in my life over time. I came into the church out in Montana, and that's where the Bison Range is. We often ate buffalo meat at the University of Montana, courtesy of the Bison Range. I mean, they had what they called surplus, and that's a nice term, but if you're a buffalo, that's not a nice term at all. And we often help dispose of the surplus bison from the Bison Range. But I that's the road that goes by the Bison Range where I famously did not ask Mrs. Graham to marry me. She says I never did. But I put a question to her, and she was going to be going back to Europe, and I didn't want, you know, I wanted her, I didn't want to put pressure on her in any way, so I just kind of asked a question, and I worded it in a way that she could have deflected it, but thankfully, under the full moon driving past the Bison Range, she did not deflect it, and 39 years later, it's kind of worked out. I do remember when I was in college out there in forestry school, there's this little thing in our lives called the Feast of Tabernacles, and we take 10 days off, well, 8 days to observe the Feast of Tabernacles. And
I remember telling my surveying teacher that I would be missing for 8 days before I ever registered from the course, and he said it was fine. And then a week before, I said, well, I'll be leaving now, and I'll be gone for 10 days. And he said, what's this all about? Come into my office. So we went into his office, and he said, you can't leave. You leave this class, you flunk. And I said, but we, have any of you been in this boat? I said, I think we worked this one out already. And he said, I have no memory of that. Well, as I've gotten older, I understand that a little better. But so I said, well, what can I do? And he said, well, are you any good with computers? Now, in 1972, that was a different question than it is now, because the computer took up a room in the building, a room about the size of this room, and you signed up for computer time, and if you got computer time at 2 a.m., you took it, because it was very difficult to get on the computer, and before you went in, you did everything in punched tapes, because that's the way that we communicated with the computer. And he said, well, the National Bison Range is trying to start to model the predictions of population for the bison out there, and it's in very primitive form, but we'd like somebody to do some preliminary work on that. So I said, and if I do this, then I can go for 10 days? And he said, yes, as long as you have it done when you come back. So I spent my feast. I don't even remember where we were. I think it was Penticton that year, and I was working on a population model for the bison range. The bison range never used it, because the bison don't care what the model says. They just populate the way they do. But still, it had something to do with my church life, and there was another incident back in 1974 that, in this troubled world, I still remember from time to time, and I actually at one time wrote this up for my friend, and so I'll be reading from that story that I wrote, but it goes back to Montana in 1974. And still, this time of year, as much as I like Ohio, as much as I love cicadas, I still, when springtime comes, I still think a lot about Montana and the friends that I had out there. At the age of 18, I transferred to the University of Montana in the School of Forestry. During my first quarter there, I was asked to be on a surveying crew. The reason I was asked to be on it was that I could yell loud, and you sometimes had to yell on a surveying crew for people to get out of the way so you could get a shot. And so this man named Dave Crabtree, who was, well, 18 like I was, asked me to be on his crew. By the end of the school year, we were very good friends. I didn't know him that well, but one spring I had my dorm room window open. I was on the first floor, and I heard banjo music. So I grabbed my 12-string guitar, and I went out, and there was Dave sitting on the stoop of the front porch playing banjo. And all banjo songs are in the key of G, so this was within my capabilities on the guitar. If you play guitar, that's the chord you know. So we played for about half an hour. And he said, how'd you like to be on my forestry crew this summer? And it turned out that his standards was that he and the other guy played banjo and guitar, and they were looking for another guitar player who could also count trees and things like that, you know. So that's basically how I came into the church, because Dave was interested in the church at that point. I phrase it that way because we didn't actually have a congregation that met in Montana at that point. There were Bible studies sometime. But over that summer that I worked on his crew, he would disappear on Saturdays, and I would go, I've told this story, I would go to his underwear drawer. This sounds kinky, but it's not. I would open the underwear drawer, and that's where he kept all his Plain Truths. And I don't know if you may remember a magazine called Tomorrow's World and the booklets. And I would read them, and then I would fold them exactly the way that I found them, put them back in his drawer, shut the drawer, and then he would come home and take an inventory of which ones I'd read that day and go tell people at Bible study what Mark Graham had been reading that week. So there were no secrets. But little, by getting to know the church people out there and what a warm and down-to-earth group of people they were, I came into God's church. And as you know, we still go out there to maintain ties with the Montana people. It was a very happy summer, and it went very quickly. By the end of it, of course, I had not only gotten to know David very well, but all the church people, and I was attending at that point. And we actually got a house together along with the other guitar player and two other young men, one of whom who lives in Pittsburgh now, and we see him occasionally. And, of course, part of, well, the main change in your life, I mean, God's way of life is not about keeping the Sabbath, but, boy, keeping the Sabbath sure is a big deal when you start living God's way of life, because that really is what calls for changes in your own life. It's sometimes difficult to negotiate, and those of you who have been Sabbath keepers in college know what I'm talking about, because college professors live in their own world. They don't consider that there is actually another world besides what they want to accomplish in their courses. And I work at a university now, and I know this to still be true. And sometimes reality has to intrude on that kind of thing, and we would often miss some classes or labs. Of course, there was always a way to make them up. We trusted in God to get us through those crises, and we trusted in God perhaps more at that time than I do now. And things generally worked out, or at least they did, up until the time that we took range ecology. Now, range ecology was taught by a professor, and I've thought about this over the years, and I finally, this year, looked him up online, and the man's name was Melvin S. Morris, or he was known as Mel Morris, and nobody called him Professor Morris, nobody called him Dr. Morris, it was always Mel Morris. He was in the country, perhaps the leading expert on range ecology, grasslands, and his specialty was the National Bison Range, and he would go up there and study the various things that grew there and help them with ways of managing it for optimal health of the range and to help the bison grow. They relied on him, but his professional life pretty much centered around that kind of thing. It meant a lot to him. He was the oldest professor at the school by far. He had actually retired in 1972, and I think this was 1974. And he actually would come out of retirement to teach these courses, and Dave and I realized that it was our last chance. This was the last time he would be teaching it if we wanted to study range ecology with the national expert on such a thing. This was our chance, so we did it. Mel Morris was a gentleman. A gentleman was defined at the School of Forestry by someone who carried a styrofoam cup around to spit their tobacco into. Other men just let it go fly. It was called snooze. I don't know how you spell snooze. I don't think anyone ever does spell snooze because you don't write it. But Mel did chew tobacco, but he would use a cup, which made him a gentleman. He also always wore field breeches, which look kind of like jodhpurs. I think the purpose is to, you know, to wear the things that can help you stride through the grass without getting caught on them. But it was also part of his reputation at that point. And he had the most beautiful collection of Stetson hats of anybody I knew. And he often wore one indoors. It was just part of his persona. But he was not only the expert, he was I don't know how to describe him. He was not mean at all, but he was a very foreboding figure. He wanted things done a certain way. You didn't give him any guff. He was respected. And so people just did it. If Mel Morris said it, you did it his way. And we took the course, and the labs were on Saturdays, but we could work that out because we could go to the various places and do the work on our own. We had the papers, and we got cleared for that. But at the end of the course, there was the big field trip to the National Bison Range, and you had to go there to pass the course, and the only way to get into the parts of the National Bison Range that we needed to go to was in the company of Mel Morris. And it was always on Saturday. So there was no way we could make it up. So we went and talked to him. Now, because Dave had been attending services 2 months longer than I had, I always looked up to him as the wiser of the two of us and the more experienced. You know, he knew how to do these things. But neither one of us were very good at talking to college professors. So we made an appointment with Mel Morris, and we weren't trembling, but we were nervous, and we went in there, and we sat down, and Mel Morris stared at us, and I thought Dave would do the talking, but he didn't. So I started, and I said, well, we need to talk to you about this Saturday lab that we have to go to. And he didn't say anything. He just looked at us and waited for the next thing, and I said, well, we can't go. And I think he swallowed his snooze at that point because people didn't say that kind of thing to Mel Morris. And I remember he had this phrase. He would often start sentences with "by and large," but he didn't just say "by and large." He would draw it out, and he would say, "Well, by and large," and he said, "by and large, I don't like this kind of thing. Why can't you come to the lab? You can't pass the course without it." And, you know, he didn't look like the Marlboro man. Mel Morris was a very large person. The few times he took his hat off, he had a head the size of that clock back there. I mean, he did not look like a Westerner. He looked like maybe an Eastern European person or a city person, but he had a mustache, and you know about people with facial hair. I mean, they're foreboding. And he was, of course, long past being flexible. He didn't have to at that point. He was kind of regal and kind of distant and not someone to be trifled with. So, again, I was hoping Dave would jump in at that point, because if you've gone to college and had to do this kind of thing, you know that you have some various phrases that you use. You say, "Well, Saturday's just not a good day for us." And that, when you think about that, that's not true. Saturday's a very good day for us. So we learned not to use that one. Or we would say things like, "Well, we have to go to a meeting that day." But when you're trying to get out of something that makes the difference between passing a course and not, you know, what kind of meeting is it? And, well, we have plans that we just can't change that day. But the thing is, so did Mel Morris. And generally people changed for him. And I kind of ran them over in my mind, and none of them sounded right. So I just kind of put my head down and I said, "Professor Morris, Saturday is the Sabbath and we can't go. We keep a Saturday Sabbath." Well, Dave didn't chew tobacco, but he would have swallowed his snooze at that point, because that's not the gambit that we usually used. So he was squirming in his chair. He was not happy with my choice. I wasn't happy with my choice, but I'd already said it at that point. Mel Morris just sat there frozen, and a frown started to build on his face, and he said nothing for like half a minute. We had no idea what was going on inside that large skull of his. And then he moved, and we knew he was still alive, and he started talking slowly, and he said, "Well, by and large, this kind of thing doesn't work. The bison trip is where you learn most about the range." And he stopped and thought, and Dave and I just prepared for our doom at that point, and we're thinking, why did we even register for this course? Well, we had to take the course, but why did we register for it with Mel Morris? And suddenly, things seemed to change. He said, "Well, I'll tell you what." He said, "My wife and I have to go back up that way the next Sunday, and I have some work that I have to do there myself, and she helps me out. You could come along with us, and I could leave you in the area where you need to do most of your work, and then I could check back with you around noon." He said, do you live near the campus?" And we did. We only lived a couple blocks away in a house. And he said, "Good. Well, you be ready at 7 o'clock and wear long sleeves, and if you don't have a hat, you can't come." He said, "Wear boots, too, because there are snakes up there." Well, we didn't care about snakes. We couldn't believe it that the great Mel Morris was offering us a way out of our problem in what seemed like a very generous style. And we thanked him, and we backed respectfully out of the office at that point. And on our walk home, we were puzzled, but we didn't talk about it because we were just kind of happy with the way it had worked out. Because Mel Morris was under no obligation to help us out, and here he was going out of his way to make sure that two boys got their lab work done. And why? We decided to quit worrying about it. Well, Sunday came, and we in our hats were out on the front porch long before Mel Morris showed up. It was May, and the sun was up a lot earlier than we were at that point. Mel's long black car, I don't remember what it was, but it was long and black, pulled up, and we got in the back seat. We said hello to Mrs. Morris first. And it's a 90-minute ride up to Moise in the Bison Range. It's up across from the Mission Mountains and the Flathead Valley up there. Mel knew his way around. All the rangers knew him. And the way we knew he was respected is that the rangers would open the gates for him. The low man on the totem pole gets to open the gates, and we figured that would be us, that we'd be hopping out of the car. But the rangers did the gates for him. And finally, we got to a secluded valley, no bison around, at the end of a dirt road, and there was barbed wire dividing one part of the slope from another. And Mel showed us where we needed to take our vegetative counts. And we would lay out a hoop, and we would inventory everything in that, and then we would take them on a grid at certain places. And this is how we would sample what the vegetation was doing there. We took a lot of measurements, and there was a lot of work to do. But Mel waved to us and left, and he trusted us to go ahead with our part of the lab work. Well, we mapped out our plots, and we started counting. And first, we did the grasses, bluebunch wheatgrass and western fescue and others, and then the forbs, which is a term for the low broadleaf plants that are not grasses. And we found plants that we'd been taught to identify, but we'd never seen because they didn't grow in the places where they'd been. So it was kind of exciting from that way for us. And we were chagrined at that point. And bear in mind, this was 1974, to find that the range was being invaded by invasive species that we just considered evil at that point. And we knew that they brought a lot of sadness to Mel Morris because he was watching his reins there change. There was spotted knapweed and Russian thistle and toad spurge. Don't those all sound like bad plants? Toad spurge couldn't possibly be a good plant. Not good for the bison to eat. There were others too, and we got through our work a lot more quickly than we had expected, but of course we had no way to get out of there at that point, and we moved to set up a few more plots. I remember the sun being very hot, and that's why we had the long sleeves, by the way. It was to keep us from getting sunburned. We certainly didn't need it for warmth, but we definitely needed the hats. A western meadowlark flew off the slope, and the wind caught him just at the right way, I remember, and he just hung there. And if you've never heard a western meadowlark song, they might be the most beautiful bird song. Very fluty and musical, and just as joyful that day as we were. We finished the last of our tallies, so we decided to take a walk, and we followed the barbed wire fence uphill, and the sky was just a clear blue bowl over us. It was a glorious day. We could see the mountains stretching out across the valley. There was enough wind blowing to keep things tolerable. It was a fine spring day, and as I said, all of Montana seemed to spread out around us. The hills would be brown very soon, but right then they were still green, and there were still wildflowers everywhere. We stopped to drink from our canteens. We wore canteens on belts then. There wasn't such a thing as bottled water. I'm old enough to precede bottled water. So we carried canteens, and we stopped and sat down for a while, and there at the top of the ridge was one bison was standing there all by himself. There wasn't any other human being around. I remember we could see golden eagles flying at that point. And the Mission Mountains, as I said, it was as though we were the first people to see that country, except for the barbed wire fence, which was behind us, and we couldn't see that. But what we didn't know much about bison. We knew a lot about grass at that point, but we didn't know that the bison posted one sentry on the top of the hill. And it was kind of to tell the rest of the herd if there was any danger around. So we didn't know that, and we were just kind of inching our way closer. You know, like they show those videos of people in Yellowstone Park who get trampled by bison because they get closer and closer and closer to them. Well, suddenly he gave a snort, and over the top of the hill came the biggest herd of bison I'd ever seen. Now, when I say that, there were probably 100 bison. And they were all different sizes. They were calves because it was springtime. They were the big ones, but you know, the ground really did shake. And, of course, we're backing up against the fence at that point because we're in a buffalo stampede. And I thought, this could end with headlines when you think about it. And it wasn't the headlines that we were supposed to be making at that point, but I don't think we were ever really in any danger. They didn't come anywhere near us. But it was quite an impressive thing to see. Later, I've thought it was one of the stupidest things I ever did. But how many people can say that they've been in a buffalo stampede and left to tell people about it? We just stood there with our mouths hanging open. We couldn't believe it. It was quite a scene. So after we figured out how to move again, we realized that we better get back to the point where we were supposed to meet up with Mel Morris. And right on time, Mel Morris showed up with his car and his wife, and he checked to make sure that we'd gotten all the data we needed, because there's no way we were coming back if we didn't. And we did, and we got in the car, and we headed home. Even with my shirt, I was quite sunburned. I was glad when he stopped and bought us all a Coke And I do remember, it's long ago enough, it was the glass bottles, you know, and we were like a Coke ad. We were just having a great time with our Coca-Cola. And the Morrises were quite cordial to us all the way back to town. Before we knew it, we were standing on the sidewalk in front of our house again, and it was an unforgettable day, obviously, because I haven't forgotten it. I still remember it. We weren't particularly surprised that Mel Morris never acknowledged us again after that. Why should he? We were just two faces in a very large class. It was full of skinny young men and women pretending to be big enough to fit into the hats that they had bought. Soon the quarter was over and he retired, and that was the last that I saw him. I got a B in range ecology. I still wondered from time to time what on earth had made him so generous to us, but eventually I quit wondering. Another year went by, and Dave and I graduated. I worked for the Forest Service briefly. During that time, I also met Taya, who had come up to Montana on a vacation while she was at Ambassador College down in Pasadena, and so that, of course, changed my life. And life moved on. We eventually moved to Los Angeles. That's where we got married. I worked as a piano player there and worked at Ambassador College. And then later we moved to Ohio. And since then, I've only seen Dave a few times. And I've never talked with him about that day, really. We're both married now. We have two kids each. I do remember that in the fall of 1987, we went out to the feast in Spokane out there. We, by that time, had Emily and David. They were little. I remember we took a few extra days, and I think we rented a car in Missoula. I might be wrong on the details, but we drove around. We visited some friends. I remember feeling like a terrible father because at one point there was a herd of cattle there, and took the kids out and went up to see the cows, and Emily said, "Oh, boy, my first cow." And she was like 5 years old, and I thought, you've never seen a cow before? What a terrible, terrible father I am. But she was very excited about it. And one of our stops was the old University of Montana. Our classes were in session at that point, so we all walked around, and we went to the bookstore, and we saw the campus, which was a pretty impressive campus. But I was hesitant about all of us going into the forestry school building because the classes were right there. I wish we had in some ways because there's beautiful murals on the wall of old-time forestry operations and kind of a history of things that had happened in Montana. But they stayed out in the car. They were quite happy. I think we'd bought some things for the kids at that point. And I just walked in and walked around. You know how it is when you're in your old haunts at that point. I was remembering various things that had happened in that building and how it was a very good time for me. But I saw an office on the second floor, and there was a man who worked in it. The name on the door said Michael Sweet. Well, Mike Sweet was one of my roommates in a house in Montana while we were taking these courses. He was not part of the church, but he was a very good friend. And I poked my head in, and there he was. And years and years later, I'd left Montana in 75, this was 87, so it had been 12 years since I'd seen him. And it was like no time had gone by at all. You know how it is with old friends. And he jumped up, and we gave each other a hug, and it was great. And I brought him outside, and he met Taya and the kids, and he told me about his life. He'd still work there. But then he had something to say, and he said it just because he thought I might want to know. It wasn't a big deal on his mind, but because I had asked who was still teaching and who was long gone. And he asked if I remembered a professor named Mel Morris. Well, I said, well, yes, I did. It turned out that Mel had died that spring. And the college, of course, had mourned his passing because he was such a big part of it. And he still did his work at the Bison Range. But there was one funny thing that came out after he died. His wife told Mike that Mel's real name wasn't Morris, and I don't know what his real name was. If you look up his biography online, it's the only name that's ever mentioned. But apparently, Mel Morris actually came from an Eastern Jewish background. And when he wanted to go into range management, he thought that that would be a detriment to his career. It was just a different time in society. And he actually changed his name and turned his back on all the Jewish upbringing that he had had when he got into range management. He felt there would be a lot of prejudice against him, and he thought that that would be a way of dealing with it. And he purged his life of every bit of Jewishness at that point. I still to this day don't understand why a person would do that, but then I wasn't in his situation. And apparently it was something that gnawed at him later in his life, that he'd turned his back on his heritage. And then I happened to think, one spring morning, just a few months after he'd retired and he was still teaching, having built his career the way that he wanted it and being on top of the world at that point in his field and having hidden his heritage from his colleagues all that time, who should wander into his office but two fresh-faced, awkward, wet-behind-the-ears goofballs who sat down and told them that they couldn't do what he wanted them to do because they kept a Saturday Sabbath. What must have rushed through his mind in that silent moment when Dave and I sat there fearing what was going to come? We don't know. We thought we were walking into a lion's den, but instead God delivered us into the hands of a man who probably didn't even know himself how merciful he would end up being to us. We didn't really change anything in his life. I haven't used my forestry degree a great deal. As you know, although Dave used his, he's retired from the Bureau of Land Management at this point. But still, he gave us the opportunity to make a go of our life, even though he was kind of at the end of his working career. I know that I will never forget Mel Morris. Maybe in the world tomorrow, we can take a stroll through the bison range with him, see how things are going, see how the bison are doing, and we can explain things to him that he didn't know, except his mind will be open in certain ways because of the background that he's always had. It seems like the least we could do. And brethren, I know that this is a difficult world, that the things that have happened this week, not talking about the calves, but really world-shaking events that have happened this week as far as Europe goes and all the disasters that take place around the world. There's floods, there's tornadoes, there's all kinds of things. That in this world, God still has our back. That we look at things that are going on and, oh, you know, we can rejoice about the calves and stuff, but we realize that that isn't the real important thing. That the important thing is not just to live God's way, but do everything we can to spread the news of God's way, and we live for a time tomorrow. And we go through life and we face many, many challenges. And, you know, the paradox of the way God helps us through our life is that there's a lot of things that we say, oh, God helped us with that. And he might not have. It might just have been time and chance. I remember one woman who said that God sent her a mourning dove to nest in her plants. And I thought, well, I know mourning doves enough to know that that's just what those dumb birds do. You know, they do it all the time. And it's possible that God did send it. I don't know. But that kind of thing happens by itself. But sometimes the thing God really does for us when he parts our Red Seas and does all kinds of other miracles for us, sometimes we're not even aware of it. I would not have been aware of it if I hadn't run into Mike Sweet a few years later. And I know I haven't used scriptures in this. I've basically just told you a story. But I hope it's a story that gives you some strength to go through your life and realize that things will work out and that God will see us through. And if anybody wants to look at the bison after services, I'm armed. Come see me.